Welcome to Successful Soccer, the podcast of ideas, tips, and discussion on becoming and staying successful in soccer. This is episode number 9, Evaluation. Hello, I'm your host, Jeffrey Pomeranka. The website is successfulsoccer.com. For this podcast, I was lucky enough to speak with Joe Clark, the men's soccer coach at Washington University. We spoke about the 7 aspects that he looks at when evaluating soccer players. I think this is going to be a great tool for all high school players who want to play soccer in college. Listen to it, think about it, and see how it can help you out. I do apologize for the low audio quality. We were in a large room at the athletic complex at Washington University that was quiet but added a significant amount of reverb. I will try and do better the next time that Joe and I talk. Now, this is a long episode, so let's get right into it. Today I'm talking with Joe Clark, the soccer coach at Washington University, and today we're going to talk about evaluating players.
All right, that sounds fun, Jeff. Good to see you. I'm excited to be on your new, what's it called?
Podcast. Yes. So can you just go ahead and give us a little example of how you evaluate players?
Well, I think there's a number of different pieces to evaluating a player, and there's certainly a lot of different ways to do that. But I want something that I can quantify, and I want something that I can discuss with players in areas. I guess the most important area that I look for is brains. You know, and when I go and watch a young man or woman play, for instance, really what catches my eye most of the time is a ball will be played to them, and they'll, on their first touch, move it to the right. There was defenders on their left, and they'll take it to the right, and they'll make a pass. And I said, whoa, I noticed that there was real thought and intent behind what they did. And if I see that there's a pattern of that, to me, that means this kid's got his head on his shoulders controlling what he's doing, and I want to pay attention to him.
So when you're talking about brains, you're talking about maybe, it sounds like, thinking in advance of what's going to happen before you get the ball type thing,
yeah,
and knowing what's going on the field?
Yeah, I don't think it's going on consciously, at least by that stage, by the stage I'm watching kids play. It's become more instinctive, but it definitely is that their brain's in control. And it's more than just on the first touch when they have the ball. When I'm discussing brains with players, I like to define it as it's how they use what they have, all the different elements of what they have. It's how they use what their teammates have. Those two things.
So when you're evaluating players, I'm assuming this is both for the current players and people that you're looking at maybe recruiting for.
Definitely.
To play on the team.
Yes.
Is there any difference in that? I mean, the way that if you know a player and know what their abilities are and know maybe what their skill level is, can you see a difference in how you evaluate their brains versus someone who you are really seeing for the first or second time play?
Well, obviously, the more familiar you are with someone, the more accurate your evaluation is going to be. And in college soccer, the NCAA so restricts your observations that they can become a bit skewed and off. You catch somebody on the right day, you catch him in a game where he has a lot of time and he's not really challenged enough, that it might be off base. But with your own players, having spent time with them every day at practice, the games, etc., I think that your evaluations can be very accurate.
Okay, so in addition to looking at a player's brains, what are the other aspects that you're trying to evaluate?
Well, I'll look at their skill level, their technical ability, the ability to make the ball do what they want it to do, control the ball, settle the ball, same thing, pass the ball, use his right foot, use his left foot, kick it over long distances, etc. So the technical ability they have with the soccer ball, that's one of the things I look at. The second thing would be his tactics. Individually, small group, threes, fours, fives, the whole team, and then even considering the scoreboard, how much time's left in the game, what the score of the game is, what the opponent is like,
how long does it take then to be able to evaluate a player's tactics?
Well, some of the things which I'm mentioning at the end there, considering the score, well, not the scoreboard, that's apparent in every game, but the weather and the referee, those are more over the long term. But I believe you can tell an individual's tactics fairly quickly. Does he, defensively, how well does he close the opponent down when he's the immediate defender versus the ball? What kind of position does he take up? What does he do when he's the second defender and he's supposed to be in a support position to help out? What is he like when he's far away from the ball? What kind of position does he take up? So you can tell that. And then when your team has the ball, does he get open to receive a pass? After he passes a ball, does he move? If he moves, if the ball moves again, does he move again? You know, those kind of things become real apparent. And that's where the brains come in. One of the next things might be commitment, you know, which to me involves his fitness level and the amount of effort, how much ground someone covers in the game. If a player has good technique, if a player has good commitment, but he doesn't have a good brain, he might run off sides all day.
Yeah.
When he gets the ball, he might have his head down all the time. He's not aware of anybody's around. So his tactics are bad. He's not looking to combine. He doesn't use what he has well at all. He could be great juggling the soccer ball. He may be able to do every Korver move in the world. But you put him between the lines and ask him to play, he doesn't get it. And his brain isn't there. And so that's why that is such an important element of the game. And really, tactics, obviously, and brain are really tied together.
Now, is there anything that, obviously, different coaches have different ideas of team tactics. Does that ever stand out when you're looking at a player that if he was playing with a different coach or having a different coach's tactics, that he might be a completely different player, either positive or negative?
Definitely. There are players. Well, obviously the game can be coached in so many different ways. If you play for a coach that is going to play the ball very direct, and nothing wrong with that, and the game is going to have a much higher percentage of head balls than the normal game, and he's counting on winning those head balls, winning the flick-ons, midfielders moving forward very quickly from their defensive end to get close to the forwards when the ball is headed so they can win the second balls, as we call them.
Yeah.
That's going to take a lot of fitness. It's going to take a lot of speed from those players. If a player isn't necessarily blessed with great speed, which you'd like everybody to have, or he's not very good in the air, let's say he's a forward whose main thing is getting balls at his feet and he can turn defenders and he can beat them on the ground, et cetera, et cetera. But everything's going to be played to him in the air and he's 5'5", and he's going to be playing against 6'1 defenders, he's not going to look the same under a coach like that versus if he played with a coach that played a more Brazilian system, shall we say.
Okay. So how do you, and maybe we're going to get a little off topic, knowing that you cannot completely control the players that you get here, how do you put them all together? Because I know that, at least here at WashU, that we have, you know, some players who are 6'5", and players who are, you know, barely 5'6" sometimes, it seems. And how do you come up with a game tactic or a team tactic that puts that all together?
It's very challenging.
Okay.
Very challenging here. And I'm not driven by size. I'm driven by balance. I would never want to have a team on the field where everybody on the field is 5'7" or 5'8", because that is going to cost us in the long run. We're just going to give up silly goals by teams that go play over us all of the time. At the same time, I'm not going to say, no, this kid can't play for us because he's only 5'6", 5'7", or 5'8". Because in our game, we're going to play with the ball on the ground enough that there's going to be room for players of all sizes, for sure. But you must pick a style that fits your team. And no matter what style, no matter what system you set up, it's going to have weaknesses. I've heard coaches talk about the blanket that's too short. So someone goes to sleep at night and their chest is a little bit cold, so they pull the blanket up, and a little while later their feet are cold.
Okay.
There's a weakness in all systems and all styles of play.
Okay. So, anyways, back to evaluating players. Let's see. We've got the brains, the skills, The commitment or how much effort they put into it. What else do you look at?
Yeah, there's plenty more. The next one is physical. Physical has become very big, and that as you watch games, you're seeing a great deal of emphasis in picking players based on physical. So it's not so much fitness, in, at least for me, in the physical, but it is size, it's strength, it's speed, quickness, agility, those components which you can improve on and you are also born with. Some people are just physically gifted. And when I talk with players about playing, let's say that there's a player who's a good soccer player, good brain, good skill, good work ratio, but he is 135 pounds and he is 5'7". And he wants to come into the college game. And I often tell him, I'll use an example. I say, hey, in your last high school season, did you have any freshmen on the team? And he'll say, yeah, we had one. I said, what was he like? Oh, he was a little bit small. You know, he probably weighed about 110 pounds and stuff. I said, tell me, did you ever come up against him? Maybe the ball was two-thirds or even three-quarters, just sitting right in front of him. He's dribbling. Maybe you're 2 yards behind him. And then he carries that ball for about 5 or 6 yards. And after about 5 yards, the ball was just in front of you, and he was kind of out of the picture. He said, yeah, it would happen all the time. I said, that's going to be you next year in the college game. And you have to get where you can compete physically. You'd like to just be a purist and say it has nothing to do with the game. But the more you're giving away physically, the more perfect you have to be in your play. Because if you're not perfect, then it becomes physical. And if they can beat you to the ball, even when you have a head start, then you got problems. If they can muscle you off the ball because you've held it too long, it's part of the game.
Yeah. And is it, you know, growing up in Germany, we were taught to play very physically. Do you see that coming over more in the United States in the past 10, 15, 20 years, that the physical play is picking up, maybe not necessarily fouling, but physical, good, hard shoulder tackles? Is it changing?
The game is changing. I don't think it's because the players are necessarily more physical than the top players used to be. It's just that there are just pure more players, and so more good teams, and more often you get 22 players out there on the field that are all pretty gifted, and the tactics of the game have changed a lot. You can turn on old films. There's a great game from like 62 or something. Eintracht Frankfurt and I'm not sure, but it was like a 7-3 game.
Yeah.
And it was with Puskas and DiStefano. But the game stands out. It's a classic game. And it stands out because a guy would have the ball and a player on his team would run down the line and he'd give him a pass and then that guy would get the ball and he'd play it down the line and someone else was running down the line and he'd get a pass. And no one was ever offsides and players were running down the line and they weren't in the screen in the picture at all, but they're not running offsides. They just get to keep running. That just doesn't happen anymore because the field is squeezed. The players are keeping the game much more compact. And as they've kept it compact, teams are trying to play over them because it's so crowded. And so the ball's going from one end of the field to the other end of the field more often. There's more races in the middle of the park with players to try to get up there closer to where the next ball's going to be. And then okay. If it just gets whacked, then they're all racing the other way. And so that's required more stamina. And coaches have picked more players that have the physical tools to do that.
Okay, makes sense. Mm-hmm. So what else, anything else in addition to all the aspects that we've already gone over? I thought there were a couple more that you said.
Yeah, there are a couple more. We have mentioned the skill side. We've mentioned the tactical side. We've mentioned the physical tools. We've mentioned the brain, the commitment level. And I think I touched on that. But that has fitness in it. And that has how much ground you cover. And when the brain's out of control, you'll have a guy who's running around on the field with a chicken with his head cut off, is what my dad used to say.
Yeah.
Just all over the place. And sometimes he needs just to hold the space and to wait. But there are guys who can run all day, but they aren't doing it very wisely. It is the fastest way to become a better player. The more ground you can cover, the more often you're in contact with the ball, either as a defender or as an attacker, the more opportunity you have to make an impact on the game. The fitter you are, the more opportunity you have to make it difficult for your opponent. So fitness is a very important part of the game if you have the attitude to do the work and pay the price.
Okay, now when you say that you have to run smart, is there any way to generalize that? Obviously, the game is huge, and there are many different instances, so running smart
timing.
When you have the ball.
Well, let's just say that you're a defender. Sometime, and you're on the far side of the field, and you can see this space up in front of you, and you really want them to get the ball over there to you in that space because there's nobody on the other team there, and if they get you that ball, you can take it all the way down the line, get a cross in, maybe even be able to go in and get a shot off. But the ball's on the other side of the field, and you have a job defensively as well. Now, you could run up there and stand up there. But now if your team loses the ball, you're on the wrong side of the field and you're in front of the ball, and the space that you're supposed to cover is wide open and the other team can go score out of it. So you have to be smart. You have to take a halfway position. You got to be prepared for your team to lose the ball so you can cover it. You got to be prepared for your team to start to get it into the middle where they can heal that field switch so that you can get up and take advantage of that space. And your brain has to be in control of the timing of your running.
Okay.
That's one. There's plenty of examples.
Sure. And while you're touching on that, I know a listener, I think it was Mike, called and or sent an email and asked, when you're making those kinds of runs, how do you let your teammates know that where you want the ball without yelling for it? Or is yelling for it the best way to do it?
Yelling for it at the right time. You're going to have to talk. I mean, if they're not seeing you, then you need to get their attention. Is the opponent now going to be aware of you? Probably. But what do you want to do? Do you want to miss the opportunity to get the pass at all because there's a chance that the opponent might be aware of you? So now I've had players that talk stupid. The guy on the field that is 65 yards away from them with the ball, with a direct opponent, maybe two of them on him, who has no chance of kicking him a ball all the way across the field. But yet this player, 65 yards away, is screaming at the top of his lungs calling for the ball.
Yeah.
That what happens is they just put that person out of their mind because there's no value in what he's saying. It's sort of like the guy who cried wolf. It's the same story. So when the chance comes and the player's in position, you make them be aware.
Okay. Thank you very much.
So
I know that was a question that came up.
It's a good question. So then after commitment and brains, another very important, and there's two more categories, is psychological. And psychological is how a player handles the stresses of the game. There are players that are just great at practice. They're great by themselves. When there's nothing on the line and it is just clear to them, they can play at their max.
Yeah.
Now, how do they get where they can go on the big field in a game that is supposed to have meaning and it can still be just pure fun to them? They can play smart, they can play with commitment, but they're still playing with lots of joy and they are maxing out as players. They are not impacted by the fact that the game has some meaning. If you lose this game, the season's over, or you're not in first place. That they can make mistakes and lose the ball, and they can just roll right off their back, and they just, it's not a big deal. Next time I know I'll do this well. A lot of players crash and burn on the psychological side of the game. They just don't want to deal with it.
So how do you coach that? I know, wasn't there a book, who was it, On Soccer by
Sven Eriksson.
Thank you.
It's a very, very good book.
And it talked about being able to make mistakes before
correct.
You can get better, correct? If
correct.
I remember, it's been a while since I've read it. So
yeah.
Is there any way to, you can evaluate that, but how do you deal with that as a coach then? Or how does a player deal with
that? Well, actually, I think at our particular university, this is a significant issue. We have players that are used to success in everything that they do, and they're very, very committed. They're very committed to their books. Whatever it is they take on, they go after it with all they have. And so when they get into that game, then they are expecting success, and if things aren't going so well, they fall apart, or they feel overly responsible. They don't want to have that incredibly important role of being the goal scorer in our team because they might fail and let everybody else down.
Yeah.
So I try to make guys aware of it. I have them read On Soccer. I try to talk to the players about, there's a couple things you can do. A, you can't have expectations for success unless you've paid the price. If you've paid the price, and you pay the price on a little by doing a little bit each day on a pretty continual basis, so that over a long period of time, you have improved, you've become better, you've become faster, you've become fitter, you've become smarter, so that there's your expectation is reasonable. You've at least gone after it, and now you want some success. And then really to try to get them. Now, that's all you can ask of yourself. That's what you can ask yourself. Did you pay the price? Because that's something that you can control. And when you get on the field is all about the joy of now getting to go out there and compete and trying to put their stamp on the game and just keeping it in perspective, because only one guy can succeed if it's measured by wins and losses. You know, and really, you can have a winner and a loser, but both teams were very successful because both teams played extremely well, worked really hard, gave all that they had. One happened to come out on top, 1-0, 2-1, and the other one lost. But it was all there, and the players could walk off the field knowing that they had done and given their best effort.
Do players, I know as a coach that I've seen that and done that with, you know, when I was coaching high school, it's like, all right, I know you guys didn't win, but you've got to look at what you did do. How long does it take a player to figure that out after a game? Because one of the things that I admire and have seen you done is you let players be upset when they lose, that it's okay. But then how long should they be able to have before they can let that go and realize that they were successful?
They can't get overwhelmed about it, and there's nothing wrong with being upset about losing. If they didn't care, then they're playing the wrong sport. I tell my players, I really want guys, they could be out on the with a bunch of guys, and all of a sudden there's a soccer ball. Hey, let's play. They had no intent to play, and they had 25 minutes, 30 minutes of spare time, and all of a sudden they decided to play. I love having players that within 2 or 3 minutes of getting the game going, now they need to win.
Yeah.
They need to win. It's part of the inside of them. They hate to lose. Everybody wants to win, but not everybody hates to lose. And there's a big, big difference. It's a big difference, and this is a psychological thing. And each really successful team probably needs 3, 4, 5 guys, and that would be unusual to find as many as 5, that have that psychological edge where they are just, there's something inside of them. It is a game, and it just fires them up. They expect to succeed. That pressure doesn't really bother them. They can just say, come on, in a way.
The better.
They bring the guys along. They carry the guys with them. They want the ball. And if they have the tools to succeed as well, they can take your team to new heights. And all the other players that are a little bit of afraid, they grow as well because they feed off of this guy. They begin to believe in themselves. And when he's gone, they are at a new level. And psychologically, they've experienced these successes, and they expect that they're going to be able to keep it, and some of them will rise to that level. It's hard to find those guys.
Yeah, I can only imagine. And probably harder to try and train someone who doesn't have that to have that, whereas you might be able to train, you know, how to juggle a ball. Giving that internal drive is probably...
Yeah, it's...
I don't even know if it's possible.
No, it's I don't know, we have some guys on our team,
yeah,
you know, that have the drive and that really want to win. What they have to, just some of them that need a little bit more growth in it is in how they handle their drive. Do they make the other players on our team better, or do they make them worse? Because there are players that have that drive that don't look at their teammates, they don't treat their teammates as they are allies going after this. that they need to help, but they look at them as obstacles. And when those players mess up, they're on their back, they're jumping on them, and they reduce those players' effectiveness. And so I spend a lot of time talking with certain guys on our team about their words, you know, and a lot of times their words, I say, you're just dealing with the past. All you're doing is complaining about a mistake somebody made that happened before in the game. That's not going
to,
you're not going to change that.
Nothing to
what
do
can
about
we
now.
Do about what is going on right now in the moment and what is going to happen in the next two moments? That's what we want to talk about with the other players.
Okay. Big. And I'm pretty sure there's one more aspect that you look at.
Lifestyle.
Lifestyle.
And that's harder for me to find out about for sure because I don't
for
hang around
players.
With my guys. Yes. But lifestyle. You could have all of these pieces and your lifestyle can destroy you. And your lifestyle. I talk with my guys that play soccer for me about fitness being a way of life. And so during the down season where we are not able to have practices as a club because of the restrictions, I said, but this isn't really hard because fitness is a way of life for you because you can't stand the idea of not doing something physically most days. And now you just have to pick and choose what you're going to do. And I said, I don't want to expect you to give all of your time. There's nothing wrong with playing basketball and doing this and doing that. That's fun and you should enjoy it. And there's benefit for all sports in doing that. At the same time, if you are that 135-pound weakling that's a really good player, but physically you can't compete, and your fitness is a way of life for you, and you are going to spend some time doing something, do you think you might be able to use part of that time to build up some strength and power and quickness so you're more capable of competing? Why don't you give 4 hours a week towards your physical development over the next 8 months? And that might have an impact. So that's part of the lifestyle cycle. And then it's making good decisions in the evenings because there are lots of alternatives that are offered
yeah.
to people that will, over the time, destroy them.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can imagine the lifestyle. Although it's probably not too bad here. A lot of places... that lifestyle when kids especially move from high school out to college where they're by themselves or responsible completely for themselves, that can just destroy.
Well, that sudden freedom for a while for many of the kids is a little bit daunting to
yeah.
control, daunting task. Yeah, and I think that they have plenty of temptation here, and I'm sure that they all have their moments. For the most part, the real strength at Washington U is the foundation of these kids is pretty solid. And that's why they do well in the classroom and do well in most of the things that they try to do. And so I don't think lifestyle, although it probably is an issue for some, it isn't an issue to the same degree as it is at some other schools where soccer is the only thing that they have solid.
Yeah. Very true. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate you spending the time to talk to me. Maybe we'll do this again sometime.
Yeah, that would
if
be fun.
There are other topics that you'd like to cover. We'll see where it goes. I've already had people requesting a video podcast, which, you know, is just so much more difficult. But anyways, who knows where this is going to go. So thank you very much, and we'll plan again to do it some other time.
There you go, Jeff.
Thanks.
No problem. Thanks.
Well, there you have it. I want to say thanks to Jeff Woolsey for the opening music. You can find more from Jeff at www.sonicduderanch.com. I also want to say thanks to Magnatune.com and specifically the artist Jag, I hope that's the correct pronunciation, for this episode's closing music song of Walkin' at Midnight. You can find that song and other great new stuff at Magnatune.com. And I want to make sure that you know that they're not a sponsor, they're not giving me any money, but at Magnatune.com, I think it's great because they allow podcasters to include their music in a podcast without any fees. As always, thanks for listening. Send your feedback to me at feedback@successfulsoccer.com. Until next time, thanks for listening.